welcome to the North Star. I'm your host, David Perel, and this is the North Star Podcast. In each episode, we explore the intersection between different ideas, cultures, and life philosophies. The guests are diverse, but they share profound similarities. They're guided by purpose, driven by curiosity, and see the world with a unique lens. And in each episode, we get to dive into their hard-earned wisdom and apply it to our lives. When I'm not recording podcasts, I write essays on my website, Perel.com, send a weekly email newsletter called Monday Musings, and run an online writing school called Rite of Passage. I hope you enjoy the show. My guest today is Claire Lehman, the founder and editor-in-chief of Quillette, a for-profit online magazine that publishes essays on topics like politics, science, and academia. We started our conversation talking about Quillette's business model and the niche it occupies on the internet. Then we moved on to more societal topics like the longevity of bureaucracies, the pros and cons of standardized tests, and what Claire would change about childhood education. Please enjoy my conversation with Claire Lehman. Well, welcome, Claire. My first question for you is, why is it important for Quillette to be a for-profit organization?
Well, thanks for having me, David. I would say that it's not essential that we're for-profit, but I think that being a for-profit company just makes your mission a little bit simpler. And I would worry that if I was a non-profit, that I would be too beholden to some of the big donors that would give Quillette money. At the moment, our business model relies on donations from readers. So we have thousands of readers who give us monthly donations. So our income stream is quite diffuse, which means we can remain editorially independent and we don't have to worry about offending someone who we've taken a large donation from, because all of our donations are small. Most of our donations are very small and they're diffuse. So it gives us a little bit more freedom and independence.
There's a idea from Basecamp. It's a software company and it's called building a static business that I've always really liked. And basically, the essence of the idea is like, you know, like when you look at television static, how, you know, it's like, you know, it's all the little dots. And so it's trying to basically show that it's, you want to have a static business in terms of safety and security, because you don't want to have a lot of, those dots represent revenue per person that you're getting. And so if like you have a lot of dots that are roughly the same size, then it's well distributed. Whereas when I was working for an ad agency, we got 35% of our revenue from one client. And it created a lot of worry within the organization.
Yeah, exactly. And I think if you're a nonprofit, I mean, I think if we were a nonprofit, we could probably get more money and we could pay ourselves higher salaries, but then we would constantly be worried that we might offend our donors. And we don't want to be worried. We want to be able to publish whatever we feel like. So it's given us freedom and it makes our mission clearer and simpler.
As you've built the company, I mean, there's almost like a supply chain of articles. How does that supply chain work in terms of publishing 7 to 10 articles per week? What is your role as an editor? And then within the people that you've hired, how do you actually think of the system that is publishing Quillette articles?
So we're quite different from a lot of other magazines in that we publish a lot of articles that come into us on a cold call basis. So we have a pitch inbox. It's pitch@quillette.com. And we receive dozens of articles a day and we go through them. I have someone that checks the pitch inbox on a daily basis. And we select quite a few articles that come into us from out of the cold and we publish them. And over the years, just through manning that pitch inbox, we've obviously developed relationships with quite good writers, and then they become repeat contributors. So we've always got material coming through, and it's just been dedication. It's not me. Like, I'm not sitting looking at the pitch inbox every day. I gave that task to my London editor, Jamie Palmer, a couple of years ago, and he's an incredibly industrious worker, and he reads essays every day. He goes through and selects the best ones, and we just keep publishing. So I'm lucky in that I have very industrious editors working for me, and we just have a very wide, at the moment, we have a very wide network of contributors and writers who write for us.
What do you think that you've learned in, say, the 6 years since you've started Quillette about publishing a high volume of articles that you wish you had known when you started?
That's an interesting question. There hasn't been a whole lot that's changed since we started. I've learned from Jamie, my colleague, that avoiding polemic articles, avoiding articles that are overly emotional and are trying to get an audience angry or get a hot response, avoiding those type of articles is actually a good thing long term, because you develop a more moderate, reasonable audience, and writers respect that, and you just develop this sort of civilized culture. And my colleague Jamie has done a lot to foster this sort of moderation that we've become known for.
I really like that. Why do you think that that seems like such a challenging thing for the media industry to do, to put it lightly?
Well, obviously, a lot of media has been chasing revenue through the advertising model. And so to do that, one, it's really easy to publish material that gets a hot response from readers, makes them angry or disgusted or enraged. And material like that can get a lot of page views very quickly. But it upsets people, makes people angry, and I think it's damaging to a brand over the long term. So the short-term strategy of chasing clicks and page views is ultimately damaging to the trust that readers have in a brand. And so with the help of my colleagues, we have sort of adopted a strategy where we don't chase clicks, we don't chase that short-term revenue or that even that short-term notoriety. And we publish reasonable, moderate material that is analytical, that appeals to people who have cooler heads rather than hot heads. And a lot of the content we publish is also evergreen. So we get a lot of traffic from older articles that we've published a couple of years ago. It's still relevant today. So although we don't chase clicks in the short term, we still get a high volume of traffic because so much of the material we publish is not just relevant to this week. It's relevant to, you know, the last 5 years or the last 10 years and so on. So we've just adopted a different strategy that is more long-term focused, I think.
Yeah, that actually, thank you for that, because it made preparing for this podcast really fun, because I could just go and I could scroll to your first articles and I read all those, the early stuff on feminism. And then I was going through 2016, 2017, and there was another thing that you did where you don't, compared to other publications, really focus on American politics, and you've much more focused on these meta points, which I really liked. And I also like what you said there. I've never quite thought of this idea of like the time horizon of clicks. People think of chasing clicks as like 48 hours, 72 hours, but really there's a kind of click chasing that you could do over a 10-year period that leads you to a very different calculus in terms of the articles that you publish.
That's right. That's exactly right. And publishing evergreen content, which, I mean, it's a vague term, but for example, we've published articles on famous writers, and you know, there's always going to be fans of Flannery O'Connor or J.D. Salinger who are Googling their favorite writer, you know, and you always find these really interesting essays about these historical figures. And that kind of writing doesn't go out of fashion. It's always interesting to the reader. We have a lot of essays that are standalone essays that we think will stand the test of time. You could read them 10 years from now and they'll still bring something to you. And so that kind of material, although it might not go viral in the moment, over a long time period can generate a lot of traffic and attract a lot of readers. And yeah, it's quite valuable to invest in.
How correlated do you think the relationship between free speech and innovation is. Have there been any studies on this? It seems like there would be a strong correlation. This is how people talk about free speech. But I don't know if the empirical data shows that the correlation is actually as strong as people assume it is.
Well, yeah, you're right. It's an empirical question, and I'm not sure. I don't have the answer to that. And I haven't actually seen any studies that have been done on that. But if you look at history, I think the societies and the cultures in which free speech has been valued tend to be more innovative. I think we can say that from reading history. And certainly institutions that promote innovation rely on feedback. So we talk about there are different reasons for having free speech, but one of the most important reasons is that we don't know when we're wrong about something. I could be wrong about something important, and unless someone else has the free speech to tell me that I'm wrong, I'm not going to be able to know and correct myself. And so a big part of why innovation and free speech are correlated is because we don't know when we're wrong, and we need other people who may have information that we're not privy to, or who may have ideas that we haven't thought of. We need them to have their freedom of expression so we can correct ourselves. And that's what science is supposed to be. It's supposed to be a self-correcting institution. So it's supposed to institutionalize methods for falsification and the testing of assumptions and the testing of findings. So there are a lot of parallels between the scientific institution and then the reasons for why we want to protect free speech in a culture. On your empirical question, I don't have the answer to that. I would be surprised if innovation could flourish for very long when free speech is curtailed. I would be surprised. Yeah. It might flourish for a short time, but I don't think over the long term, over multiple generations.
Right. Well, I think that that's a sort of a really interesting question that a lot of Westerners feel now looking at what's happened in Asia, because there's countries like Singapore. I wouldn't say that Singapore's really restricted free speech, but there certainly are liberties that Singaporeans don't have that Americans say, oh, we have those liberties. And then we look at China and we say, well, maybe their centralized government allows them to take on big projects that we can't. And I think that that's a big concern in Western culture. You know, like what I'm trying to sort of think through here is maybe even aside from the success of a society, there's a certain just axiom that we should believe in free speech from like a moral perspective or from like a human rights perspective that is aside from the success of a society itself.
Yeah. Well, I think a good example to look at historically would be the Soviet Union. So the Soviet Union poured a lot of money and effort into scientific projects and big state projects, like, you know, going to the moon. But when you put inhibitions on people to criticize freely, be able to critique people in positions of authority, it inhibits the truth, basically. So if you've got bureaucrats running scientists, like if you've got state bureaucrats telling scientists, you have to work on this project and you have to get these results, and then the scientists are working on it and they can't get the results, or they might get results that are undermine the project's overall aim, and they feel inhibited to sort of tell the bureaucrats or stand up to the bureaucrats, then the entire project is going to suffer. So unless you give people the freedom to criticize those who are in positions of authority, I think ultimately big projects that rely on data and truth as being essential to their functioning, I think they're going to suffer. And I think if you look at the comparison between the Soviet Union and the United States, you can see how a society that had free speech as a value ultimately won against a society that didn't. But you're right, it is an empirical question, and we might see in 100 years from now that societies that don't have free speech as a value win the geopolitical contest. We really don't know. We shouldn't be complacent.
Yeah. Within the university system, What do you see as the core flaws of what's happening in universities besides the way that a lot of it is swung left and the student debt crisis?
Yeah, well, I think a big problem with universities is that too many people go. I don't think university is for everybody, and I don't think one needs to have a degree to do a lot of jobs. And I think it's really unfortunate that we've encouraged a couple of generations of young people now to spend 4 years at university when they may not have really wanted to go, may not have necessarily enjoyed their time at university. And the result of too many people going to university is what you would call credential inflation.
Right.
So a degree means less. So if more people have a bachelor's degree, it's less valuable. Its value is diluted. And then to distinguish yourself from a person who has a bachelor's degree, you have to go and get a master's degree. And that just chews up young people's time. It's a massive opportunity cost when people could be starting businesses, contributing to whatever field they want to go into. Just think it's contributed to a waste of time, a waste of money. And the inflation of credentials is bad for social mobility, economic inequality. So I think the idea was to make education available to everyone, which is a noble goal, but not everyone needs to go. Everyone should have the opportunity to go. There shouldn't be barriers, but we shouldn't tell young people that you must go to university to have a good life, to have a good job, to get into the middle class. It shouldn't be a requirement.
So I strongly agree with what you're saying. And I think a lot of the ways that society goes wrong is when we take two words and we treat them like perfect synonyms, even though they are just highly correlated. And in this case, it is education and college. They are not synonyms. College is a way to get an education, but it is not education.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Not necessarily learning. To go to universities to gain a credential primarily, and a lot of people can gain credentials without receiving an education, unfortunately.
Mm. Yeah, well, I've been thinking a lot about this because I've been trying to figure out how it sort of breaks. And I think that one of the things that is very good is the rise of new vocational institutions. I think that we really need to sort of split university among people who want to go to get a job. But then leading into my next question, people who want to go to get that more traditional university education. Like, I've been reading a lot of Thomas Jefferson's original writing on his vision for the University of Virginia. And one of the things that was so innovative about what he was doing was he wanted to take the most talented people in the state of Virginia and give them free education. And when they went, he was very precise and explicit about the fact that education was not just about, in his day, training farmers, the vocation of what you did. It was about training these complete citizens. And with Ben Franklin in particular at the time, one of his big pieces of blasphemy was that he didn't want to train students to study Greek and Latin, because at the time that was seen as such a erudite thing to do. But what both of them saw was that education would train this holistic being. And what worries me from having graduated from college only 4 years ago is that we are training corporate drones who are spending too much money at school to even be able to justify the lack of return of investment to study anything outside of business or something that's going to get you a job.
Yeah. Oh, I think you've hit the nail on the head. I think, thankfully, in Australia, things aren't as competitive. So we don't have the equivalent of your Ivy League colleges where people's parents have to pay an arm and a leg to get their kids into. They're super restrictive. We don't have that system here in Australia, thankfully. And it's a bit more relaxed. So people can go to university and, you know, study the history of medicine or, you know, something obscure and, you know, still expect to get a decent sort of professional job. But I think the system right now in the United States is very scary, and how much tuition costs have increased while the return to students and families just has remained stagnant. And I it's a bubble that I hope pops soon, because I don't think it's good for your society, and it's not good for the individuals caught up in that system either.
Yeah, one of the things I've been thinking a lot about is within the liberal arts in particular, I find it quite bizarre. So I was looking, I've been really trapped in how I can study philosophy at a high level. And I've tried a lot of different options. I've tried personal groups, but the problem is no one takes them seriously enough. I've tried meetups, but once again, nobody takes them seriously enough. And then I audited a class at Columbia earlier this spring, and it was just not very good. And I would have had to pay so much money to do that. And so I was on the site for the BPhil master's program at Oxford, like one of the highest, most prestigious graduate school programs. And of the people who graduated from the school, about 80 to 90% from this master's program went into become career academics. And the curriculum is explicitly designed to train people to be professional academics. And the analogy here is with these liberal arts questions, these questions that are supposed to go on for life, is something like religion. No one would ever say at a church, you should only deepen your relationship with God from the years of 18 to 22 in particular, and then from 22 to 30 or so, you can only study it if your intention is to go be a priest or a pastor. No one would ever say that, but that's exactly what we've done with the university, and I think that's quite bizarre.
It is bizarre, and it's a question. I think what you're talking about is, why have we lost this concept of lifelong learning and education? Why have we lost that? Where did it go, and who destroyed it? Was it the universities themselves? Was it our societies and our culture? Is it the corporate world? I don't have the answer to those questions, but I think you've identified something that's very true. Like, we've lost this notion that a part of being a good citizen is dedicating a big part of your life to constant lifelong learning, education, and learning from the classics, our history, our ancestors, the wisdom of ancient texts. I mean, that used to be almost a given. You know, when you mentioned Thomas Jefferson and Ben Franklin, that was just part of being a whole individual, a whole person. But for some reason, we've conflated lifelong learning and education with credentialism. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not worth it unless you get a certificate you can put on your wall. And it's not even worth it unless you have to pay $200,000 to do it. You know, I don't have the answer to that question, but it's certainly something that we are the worse off for having lost.
I agree. As we're talking about sort of the meta thing here, could be something along the lines of bureaucracy. Do you think it's possible to turn around a bureaucracy? Is that a kind of knowledge that we have in our society, or do we have to tear it all down and rebuild it from scratch?
Good question. And I don't really know if I have the answer. And I've been thinking about bureaucracy. I think the danger is just how large it gets. Because if you think about, in Australia, we call it the public service. I'm not sure if that's what you call it in the United States. We call it the public service. So bureaucrats are supposed to be in service of the public. Mm-hmm. But if a bureaucracy gets too large, the public are in service of the bureaucracy. Mm-hmm. And an interesting situation is playing out right now in Australia, where the state which has the highest number of bureaucrats per capita, public servants per capita, is currently under a hard lockdown due to coronavirus. And I mean, they've also had a recent spike. And
this is Victoria?
Yeah. So they've been dealing with a pretty horrible outbreak. But the Premier of Victoria recently proposed that he would put the state under another 12 months of a state of emergency, which would give the government sort of unprecedented powers to sort of go under lockdown whenever they chose and to have more powers than they normally would. Now, Victoria is a state which has an incredible number of public servants who will receive a paycheck even when the state is under a severe lockdown, while small business owners see their businesses destroyed. And it's been interesting for me to see the contrast between Victoria and New South Wales, which is the state that I live in, which has a much higher proportion of businesses and small businesses and economic output compared to Victoria, and our Premier resisting calls for lockdowns. And I think, you know, in a state where the public service is smaller and sees themselves as being, you know, secondary to the class of people who generate economic output, that is much healthier than in the opposing or the contrasting situation where you've got a state such as Victoria where you've just got thousands and thousands of public servants who just receive a steady salary from the government no matter how much economic activity is happening. And the state sort of seems to be operating in service of these people who receive this check from the government. And I think, you know, I mean, we don't know what the results will be from this sort of like natural experiment of like one state going under severe lockdown and another not, but it's going to be interesting to see. And I think Victoria is possibly an example of just bureaucracy getting out of control.
I think that this is one of the most important fields of study that I have never heard of somebody actually studying. But one of the ways I consume the news is like every now and then I will just get really into a story. And often they're around bureaucracy. It's sort of like the lens that I get really into. And the one that I was fascinated by was the Boeing 737 crashes and what happened with the company. And it was so what I did was I wrote an essay that went back and I just traced all of these events that happened. And so the crashes happened in early 2019, but the actual genesis of what happened was the McDonnell Douglas Boeing merger in like 1996. And there's a famous saying that McDonnell Douglas, which was a military contractor, and Boeing was an engineering-driven company, and the military contractor McDonnell Douglas was very bureaucratic. The famous saying is that McDonnell Douglas bought Boeing with Boeing's money. So Boeing adopted the culture. 2001, a guy named Herbert Smith wrote an internal memo that had leaked that was saying, because we are going for the profit motive so intensely, we want to outsource everything. He predicted that it would hurt the quality of Boeing airplanes. And what he wrote in the memo came like 80-85% true, but almost two decades later. And it got me thinking, like, does Boeing even have a chance to turn around this company? And it pains me. It absolutely just is like a knife to my soul because I love aviation, I love America, and I'm not sure that Boeing can turn it around.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting example. And it might be that any organization that gets too large dies. You know, maybe organizations have a life cycle. And when they just start and they're small and they're run by founders, they're very dynamic and, you know, they're fluid, they can adapt to different environmental sort of inputs, and, you know, they don't worry about processes and they're highly, you know, they're not risk averse. But then the larger an organization gets, potentially the more risk averse it gets, and unfortunately the more substandard, mediocre employees get into the mix. People have a big role, and the larger an organization is, probably the, you know, the more diluted the talent is. And maybe, you know, maybe organizations just have a life cycle. And just like government bureaucracies, extremely large corporate bureaucracies, maybe they end up functioning just in exactly the same way as government bureaucracies do.
True or false, psychology as a field of study itself is overrated, but as a lens to look at other industries is underrated.
I would say false. I think it's a really good field of study because just because you learn statistics, basically. Mm-hmm. I think research design and statistics are underrated. I think the content in psychology textbooks is massively overrated. Like, you don't need to learn about studies that have been done because a lot of them haven't been able to be replicated. But just learning about experimental design and then learning statistics is really useful. But you can learn those things in other scientific domains anyway. So I suppose if you were swapping psychology for biology, that would be fine, but I wouldn't swap psychology for English because having statistical literacy is really important, particularly in this era, in this moment where we're flooded with so much information and we need to be able to think critically and we need to be able to distinguish between just noise and signal. Having statistical literacy is really useful.
Are there aspects of psychology that you think are understudied?
Oh, definitely. Huge aspects. So I'm a fan of evolutionary psychology. I think understanding reasons why certain behaviors exist is really helpful for self-awareness and living a deliberate life. So people, I mean, there's a lot of confusion about what evolutionary psychology is. All it really is the why of behavior. So it's just a different level of analysis. So if you're looking at cognitive psychology, you're trying to understand the what of a behavior. Or if you're looking at neuroscience, like even you're looking at the what in a more granular detail or the mechanism of a behavior. But evolutionary psychology is looking at the same behavior, but just trying to understand why. Mm-hmm. Why has this behavior evolved? Why does it persist? Why do we see it in cultures all over the world? Why might it be different between men and women? Why, you know, it's just explaining it at a different level. And I find that, I just find that fascinating. And cross-cultural psychology is probably understudied as well. A lot of psychology has only looked at what you call Western educated, industrialized, rich, democratic populations, mm-hmm. weird populations. And a lot of psychology studies has only really used sort of undergraduate American students as samples. So some behaviors have been generalized to be universal when they're not really universal. So cross-cultural psychology is absolutely fascinating because it shows, it actually does show how culturally constructed some of our behaviors are and how universal some other behaviors are. So it gives you that rich understanding of some of the more fundamental universal patterns while some of the detail becomes culturally expressed.
I wonder if there's like a ticking time bomb on cross-cultural psychology. I mean, I'm going to parrot this, but just to make a point, like, what if we are having such homogenization of cultures due to globalization that within 50 years we're all just going to be the same and every country is going to be equally diverse? Then we're not going to be able to do these cross-cultural studies like we would have been able to when Margaret Mead went into these places as a anthropologist and maybe went into Papua New Guinea or something and was like the first Westerner. Or like, I remember I went to rural China in 2006 with my blonde-haired cousin and all the Chinese would run up to him because they were like, blonde hair is the first blonde person they had seen in their life.
Well, I think we've passed the point of peak homogenization, and that probably happened in the 1990s or the early 2000s. And I think we're going to revert back to a more localized, balkanized world. I think that's going to be one of the stories of the 21st century. So no, I don't. I think cross-cultural psychology will still be a very relevant and important field of study. Yeah, and I don't think there's a risk that globalization will lead to a homogenous global culture. I don't think that we're at risk of that.
There's a way of looking at Quillette as trying to advocate for Enlightenment values and having the values of the Enlightenment be part of the metaphysics of the Quillette worldview, if I can call it that, What idea from the Enlightenment, though, do you think we most got wrong and should be questioning?
I think that's a really good question. I'll try and answer it. I mean, it's difficult to answer without reference to a specific philosopher or a specific school of thought, but see, I'm very much of the view that we should use rationality and reason to guide our decisions. And I don't consider myself to be a conservative, but I think that we risk in knocking down tradition through using our reason and rationality to sort of come up with new ideas. In getting rid of tradition, we might not fully understand what that tradition was there for in the first place. Mm-hmm. So I think it's important to acknowledge that traditions exist for reasons for which we might not understand. So if you look at traditional institutions like marriage or, you know, having children raised by two biological, you know, parents biologically related to them, or having, or even having religious traditions in a society. If you look at various traditional institutions, we might be able to think with our rational minds for alternatives for those institutions and improvements, but we might not be fully aware of why those traditions evolved and what might happen if we just got rid of them. And I think that's something that just being humble and being aware that we don't have all of the knowledge required to fully understand why traditions were built up over time and what problems they were originally solving. I think having that awareness puts a bit of a, it tempers or moderates the rationalist view that we can perfect everything just through our capacities for reason.
Yeah, my dad got mad at me a couple weeks ago because I was eating a steak and I had finished my steak and it was a delicious, juicy, blood-filled steak. And so then I finished the steak and I was slurping the blood. And so I was going like, and it was, you know, it was delicious, right? It was all buttery and stuff. And my dad said, don't do that. Like, that is taboo in our Jewish culture. You cannot do that. And I said, why? And he said, well, it comes because a lot of the diseases that were transmitted were from people eating or drinking the blood of meat, just like what you just did. And so there's reasons for this. And that's why it's become a taboo. And I think that there's a lot of wisdom to that.
Yeah, and we can often look at these traditions and just say, well, we've solved that problem. We don't have parasites. You know, I know this meat doesn't have a parasite in it, so I can do this. But there might be even deeper reasons that we're still not aware of. Do you know what I mean? And we just have to always be, I think we need to combine reason with epistemological humility and just the awareness that there are lots of things in the world that we still don't understand. That's not apologism for like a supernatural or religious worldview. I think, you know, one day we might be able to understand a whole lot more just through using the scientific method, but we still have to be humble and acknowledge that there's quite a lot that we don't know yet. And there's quite a lot about traditions that we still don't fully understand.
Related idea, not quite the same thing, but I've been thinking, running an education business, you know, I have all these people who reach out. They're like, how do you do it? How do you teach people? And how do you run a really effective course? And I'm like, well, I could tell you, but I don't feel like I can actually tell you, right? Like there's a certain amount of, like there's almost three categories. There's like stuff that I can tell you, stuff that I can write down, and stuff that you just got to do it to learn. And so my point is that there's a lot within history of just tacit knowledge. And you could also call this like what tradition is like tacit wisdom, that to like take the metaphor, it's in that sort of you just got to do it and you'll learn category.
That's an interesting way of putting it. Yeah. And traditions, maybe you could also call them social knowledge. There's all sorts of ways that communities and societies sort of like hold together into cohesive groups or tribes or like units, organizational units of their own. So if you think about like when we were evolving, communities had to sort of compete with each other. So there are all of these mechanisms by which communities like hold together, like you call it the social glue or whatever. And, you know, I think traditions probably have a lot to do with that. Shared customs, rituals. And we don't, because our society is so focused on the individual and, you know, individual self-determination, we sort of forget that there are all of these practices which help societies function. And if we get rid of them, our societies can fall apart.
Well, I'll ask this question, and I hope you don't take it offensively, but I felt it very strongly when I was in Australia. I felt like I couldn't find good ideas in Australia in the conversations that I was having. Why doesn't Australia have a very strong intellectual culture? Is it the climate? Is it the kinds of people who ended up in Australia? I couldn't figure it out.
Yeah, it's a sad part of our culture. I mean, I love Australia. I really love Australia, but we do not have an intellectual culture. So I'm not surprised that you couldn't find good ideas. We're rich and we're dumb. So part of it is climate. So we have great weather and great beaches. So a lot of like we spend a lot of our leisure time just out at the beach, at this like hiking, you know, which is all wonderful. But we don't spend a lot of time indoors sort of talking about literature or films or art and so on. So we haven't developed that as part of our cultural identity. Another reason is because Australia is full of natural resources. So we're a rich country because we've just had to dig up coal out of the ground and sell it to China. We've got all of this money. And all of this money to just circulating inside the country for people to spend on services, to spend on coffee. So we have great restaurants and we have great sort of leisure culture amenity, but our economy is not at all innovative. So we don't have a great tradition or history of people, you know, really solving technological problems. I mean, we do have, you know, there's always exceptions to the rule. So we invented Wi-Fi and there are companies like Atlassian that come from Australia, but it's not comparable to other parts of the world like America or Israel or some parts of Europe or South Korea. So I think it's the way I explain our lack of intellectual culture is basically we're too lucky. We can earn money too easily. And because the climate and our natural environment is so glorious, we can just have a good time by just, you know, going outside rather than really going inward and developing inner interior worlds for sort of entertainment. And then the other reason is that we're isolated. So we're this island, you know, at the bottom of Asia, we're separated from Europe, we're far away from America. I mean, you know, you have to fly across the Pacific Ocean. So we're just quite isolated and it means that we become quite parochial. You know, we look inwards and I think that's just a function of our geography.
What should we change about childhood education? What are your kids, like 4 years old?
Yeah, so I have a 7-year-old and my daughter's turning 4 on Monday. On childhood education, I've learned a couple of things from publishing articles on Quillette from education researchers. And what I've learned is that in the early years in primary education, children should basically just be taught facts. When children are young, they just need to learn facts. And when they're older, they can synthesize those facts and think critically and creatively. But focusing on what you would call critical thinking in primary school is a waste of time because it's just a capacity that sort of comes naturally as children are able to think abstractly. What children really need to give them a solid foundation later on in life is factual knowledge. And you can't really think critically unless you have a foundation of knowledge to think critically with. And so I have become a little bit critical of some of the programs in schools that are just about, you know, fostering creativity or fostering, you know, more abstract thinking abilities, which I don't think is necessary in young kids. I mean, it's not like I want children to be in school just rote learning from 8:30 to 3:30. I want children to be able to have fun, and I'm not an advocate for returning to sort of harsh, strict conditions where kids are just led by a drill sergeant up the front of the classroom. But I think that particularly with children who are perhaps disadvantaged or don't have, you know, a lot of books in the home, or their parents aren't necessarily giving them a lot of education in the home environment, those kids in particular really need to be just learning facts at school.
What is it about facts that are so important? That's not intuitive to me.
The brain is the young brain in particular is like a sponge for facts, and your long-term memory is almost infinite. We can store an infinite amount of information in our long-term memory. When we are thinking creatively or thinking critically and we're synthesizing information, we're using our working memory, and our working memory gets overloaded really easily. You can only hold a couple of items in your working memory at one time. So you can't store factual information while you're trying to solve problems with it. You have to learn the factual information, stick it in your long-term memory, in your infinite storage facility, and then when you're trying to think creatively or think critically and you're trying to synthesize disparate parts of information using your working memory, then you can use it. So the point is simply that the young brain is like a sponge for information. You can give a young kid an amazing amount of information that they will retain forever. And then when they get older and when they want to solve problems and synthesize disparate parts of information, they're able to do that because they have that solid foundation. So if I think about my son, he knows more about all sorts of different topics than I do. So he knows more about human anatomy, biology, plants, astronomy, dinosaurs, like all of this information just from YouTube, just from getting onto YouTube, watching videos, like documentary style videos, and then going and reading books. He's just a sponge for this information. So when he gets older and he wants to like come up with a hypothesis in biology or whatever, or medicine, he'll be able to reach back and have that huge store of information that he's built up over his childhood to sort of inform him.
Yeah, I smile because I was at dinner, this must have been like 5 years ago, and I was with my friend Brett. We're in New Jersey, and we're about to sit down for dinner, and his little 11-year-old brother walks in. It's like one of those houses with like tons of kids, so it's a crazy place. And his little 11-year-old brother walks in and starts talking to us about World War I. And I don't know a lot about World War I. And this kid had just gone through the entire PBS crash course history of World War I. And went on and on and on about the geopolitical dynamics of World War I and the way that it began, the way that it ended, how different countries were evolving, who all the leaders were. And I was like, are you a scholar of World War I? The kid was 11 years old. And I think that you're saying something here that I've never considered around facts. And then if you combine facts with YouTube, you have something really interesting that's emerging around childhood education, because YouTube is so effective at entertaining kids.
Yeah. No, I mean, there's this channel called Kids Learning Tube, which puts all of this factual information into songs, to music. And toddlers can sit down. My son was learning about the bones in the foot. And, you know, he knows the names of all of the bones in the human body just from watching this channel. It's really incredible. And our kids are sort of the first generation of kids who will grow up in this incredibly information rich environment. And it's like risky in some ways because there's disinformation out there as well. But if they're accessing material on science and history, and it's not disinformation, there's incredible opportunities for them to learn like never before, really.
As your kids get older, what do you think are the pros and cons of standardized testing? I've read articles from people saying, oh, they're awful in that they don't actually measure intelligence well at all. I hated standardized tests. I did very poorly on them. So when I was applying to colleges, had I not been a decent golfer, I would have never gotten into the college I got into. And so I felt very disadvantaged by standardized tests. But then on the other hand, I think those arguments are both pretty legitimate. And then on the other hand, they are actually an equalizing force, and they give people from disadvantaged backgrounds who want to work hard or who are just super intelligent. If you get a 1600 on the SAT, well, you have shown a level of competence that a lot of society won't actually see. So where do you stand in the duality between those two arguments?
I tend to be pro standardized testing for that very reason, that it's the best tool we have for disadvantaged kids to really be recognized for their potential and their talents. That being said, I'm a person who has mixed abilities and sort of like a what you would call a spiky cognitive profile. So I have strengths in some areas and weaknesses in others. So my strengths don't always show up depending on the standardized test that is used. So I fully understand and relate to the perspective that, you know, they don't always show a person's full capacity or full potential. Absolutely. But at the same time, I think there's just no other way for kids from disadvantaged backgrounds to really prove themselves, because, you know, children from privileged or middle class or upper middle class backgrounds just have so many opportunities. Like their parents give them opportunities to try different sports, to try different musical instruments, to try languages, to do volunteer work. Like you just have so many, kids have so many opportunities. But when you're from a disadvantaged background, you don't have those opportunities, and the only opportunity you may have is like a pencil and paper test that shows that you are a bright kid. And I think social mobility relies on bright kids from disadvantaged backgrounds being able to access high quality education. And I think standardized tests are the best way to do that.
Yeah, to go back to Jefferson, one of his most interesting ideas was, and we don't know how to have this conversation in at least America right now. So Jefferson sort of started with the axiom that there will always be elites in a society. But what he didn't want was an elite that just stayed the same from generation to generation, where the wealth was inherited, and that was the only way that elitism would happen. Because what he thought would happen, and I think he's right, is that the wealthy would overtake the political, and they would shape the political for the wealthy. And so what he wanted was the churn in elites. And he said, elitehood, elitism is fine. Like, that is what we need in societies, provided that we have ways for that mobility that you're talking about to actually come to fruition. And I think he's right about that.
I think he's definitely right. And one thing that people don't fully understand is that because of regression to the mean, there will always be churn. So if you can get a very bright individual who achieves amazing things in his or her life, statistically, he or she is likely to have a more average kid. But if your elite class of elites is only determined by wealth, that average kid is going to stay in that elite class. Whereas a brilliant child of average parents in a lower class won't have that opportunity. But because of the way genetics works and because of regression to the mean, there is a natural churn just in nature, in abilities. So I think I think Jefferson's right. I mean, we know that even in families, there's a standard deviation between siblings. So it's common for one sibling to be one standard deviation more intelligent than another sibling. So there's natural variation even among people who are very genetically similar. So we have to have mechanisms for people in upper classes to sort of have downward social mobility and people of lower classes to have upward social mobility.
You were talking about your strengths and weaknesses before. So let's try to achieve the impossible. People love to be super humble when they talk about their strengths. I'm going to challenge you not to be. What do you think those strengths and weaknesses are? Because you were talking about how lumpy your profile is. And I'd love to just get a view of what are the things that you're actually exceptional at?
I'm pretty good at filtering out the trivial. It's both my weakness and my strength. So my weakness is that I don't have attention to detail and I focus on meta perspectives and big picture things. But that's also my strength. So I saw that there was a market for Quillette back in 2015. Like I saw all of these things that are common knowledge now, like cancel culture and political polarization and left-wing bias in the academy. I saw all of those issues before anyone else was really talking about them. And I saw an opportunity for a business to be successful in that niche. But if I was more detail focused, I might have missed that big picture perspective. So it's both a strength and a weakness. I think I'm quite good at synthesizing cultural trends and seeing where they might head in the future. And that's useful for an entrepreneur, but yeah, I can't think of too many other areas where that's a useful skill or ability to have, except maybe being like a novelist or a writer or something like that.
How do you think you've become good at looking at cultural trends?
I was an avid reader as a kid. I read novels and historical novels, and I've always just had an affinity for aesthetic and cultural sort of fashions and trends. And I've read a fair bit of cultural history, and it's like fashion. So lots of my girlfriends were into fashion, and they could sort of predict fashion trends that might happen a couple of years down the track. Well, I was sort of like that, but for cultural trends. So what might be in fashion in terms of like, you know, political opinions or something like that. I sort of had it at the more cerebral, the interest in fashion at the cerebral level as opposed to the clothing level, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. So I went and looked at your Goodreads profile and I found three books, and talk about why one of these impacted you. You can pick The Custom of the Country, Pride and Prejudice, or Liars in Love.
The Custom of the Country is an underrated novel. That's a novel by Edith Wharton, an American writer, and it's underrated for a couple of reasons. Firstly, the main character is an anti-heroine. She's a female sociopath. And there aren't that many female sociopaths in literature or even in film. But when they are depicted, it can be really interesting. And the sociopath in Custom of the Country is a gold digger. She's this beautiful girl from a humble, modest background, some small town in America. And she's beautiful and charming, and she marries into sort of old money in New York, and then divorces the guy and devastates him. And then she marries an aristocrat in Europe and divorces that guy and takes away some of his family heirlooms and ends up with someone from her small town in America who has discovered oil. So he's a billionaire. And it's this biting commentary on sort of the amorality of money and materialism, but it's also, at the same time, it's also quite inspiring. Because you've got this girl from this humble background and she ends up with this boy from a humble background in this small town of America, but together they dwarf these old money families in Europe and New York. It's just really quite, it's scary but inspiring at the same time, and it reflects something about America that I can't quite put my finger on, but it's a great novel.
What do you mean by the amorality of materialism? That's a beautiful turn of words.
Well, there's just, I mean, materialism and accumulation of wealth, it has its own momentum, and it doesn't necessarily have a conscience. Like it's almost like its own natural force. And like nature, it's amoral. So, I mean, you know, when natural disasters happen, it's not, we don't complain about them being evil, or it's amoral. There's no morality in it. And I think a big part of the American dream, which is making money and, you know, having those opportunities to be socially mobile. I mean, it's wonderful on the one hand because of the opportunity. On the other hand, it is also amoral because sort of once you get into that path where you're accumulating that wealth, it just takes on a life of its own.
Have you seen any data on the psychology of media, but not like the way that's sort of been parroted of like the shallows of like the internet is destroying our brains, but like anything on the evolution from print to television to now moving to this very imagistic society that might even be post-literate, and what that means for our brains? And I'm not trying to ask a leading question in a good or bad way. I think that there's both within that.
Well, I think listening to voices, so talking, I think one of the reasons why podcasts are so popular is that it's more natural to us to listen to stories and voices than it is to read. So we, you know, we have to learn to read, but we don't have to learn, like we little children learn to listen and hear voices before they learn to read. So reading is like it doesn't necessarily come naturally. It's a learned skill. So I think we're probably just becoming more efficient and effective at consuming content which we're interested in. And it just means that certain media is just going to be more popular and more accessible than others.
What do you think people outside of Australia have to learn about the country? I mean, I'll go ahead and I'll give my answer, and I'd like to hear yours. But the first thing that Australians can learn from at least America is a lot of conversations in Australia that I've had with Australians in America have been around tall poppy syndrome, of being cut down if you are at the top. And I'm not sure what the specifics are of what that actually looks like in practical reality, but it has been such a recurring theme. But then one of the best parts about visiting the beaches, say Bondi, was you go to Bondi, you go to the part that has all the photos, the swimming pools, it was like $8 to swim there. Like, it wasn't expensive at all. And in America, like if you take a city like Las Vegas, which is almost like the amoral materialism taken to its extreme that you were just talking about, everything costs money. Like, if you go to Vegas, there's almost nothing that you can do that, besides just walking the strip, that is truly entertaining, that won't set you back a lot. And I like how Australia has made a lot of its most beautiful places open to the public.
Yeah. Well, something that's nice about our culture is our egalitarianism. So, I mean, that ties in with tall poppy syndrome. And there are good things and bad things that come along with that. So one good thing is that we don't use every opportunity to make money. And so it doesn't cost money to, you know, to go to beautiful spots. And, you know, we have a certain public understanding that, you know, there, things can be shared and there's nothing wrong with that. The bad thing about the tall poppy syndrome is simply that once people get to be very successful, they're sometimes criticized or torn down by people who want everyone to stay equal or the same on the same level. So it's good and it's bad.
Last question. Of all the articles that have ever been published on Quillette, which one has impacted you the most? Has just made you say, whoa, I have never thought of it like that. It has now become a staple, a pillar of your worldview.
Oh, that's a great question. I don't know if I can identify one in particular, but certainly when we first started, there was a theme coming through about progressivism or certain political positions within the academy being akin to religious impulse that changed my views. I wasn't thinking along those lines back in 2015 when I created Quillette, but now it's almost a cliche to say that universities are like churches. But when I started, it wasn't a cliche. It was sort of a novel concept, and that idea came through in a few essays, and it really changed the way I think about the world. But I would just say that over the years, I've learned a great deal from my writers, like cumulatively. I've learned a lot about history, economics, different areas of science. And it's an amazing privilege to be able to edit and read these marvelous essays from experts in their fields. It's just an incredible privilege, and I've learned so much over the years from reading the essays that I publish.
Yeah, I think I found more interesting people through Quillette than any other website on the internet except for Twitter. So thanks for the work that you do.
That's wonderful. That's great feedback. I'm very proud. That's really great to hear.
Thank you very much, Claire.
No worries, David. Thank you.
Hey again, it's David here one more time. Before you leave, I want to tell you about my online writing school called Rite of Passage. Now, it's nothing like the boring writing classes you took in school. It's made for curious people just like you who want to write more, think better, and use the internet to spark incredible friendships. And don't tell your English teacher I said this, but there's no talks of adverbs or conjunctions. None of that boring stuff. Rite of Passage is way more practical than that. See, I've taken everything I've learned from interviewing some of the world's most effective people on this podcast, and I've asked them how they write, and then I distilled those lessons into a powerful set of principles for helping you write better. If you want to start writing online, Rite of Passage is the best place to begin. That's all for today, and thanks so much for listening.